Let's get things started here with Bang this afternoon as we welcome to the program, like we do every Tuesday, our friend, writer, and critic, Colin Fleming. Hello there, Mr. Fleming.
Hey, how are you?
I am doing very well, thank you. Yourself?
Okay.
It's baseball playoff season, for goodness sakes, and those Red Sox fans with a memory can look back to some, well, less than stellar performances in one-game playoffs.
Oh, they sure can. And Red Sox fans, we own the market for one-game playoffs for a while because there were no other forms of playoffs. And one-game playoffs, they didn't happen, except basically twice. One of them happened 40 years ago on this very day, the Bucky Dent game at Fenway Park, when the Yankees had not just clawed their way from 14 games back in mid-July, but they were up in the loss column, the Yankees were now, four games on September 16th. You're pretty much cooked if you're four games back in the loss column that late in the season. And having collapsed like the Red Sox did, I think you have to give them some credit for spiritedness, at least, to do what they did at the end of the season, which was to win eight straight games. And they needed the Yankees to lose their last game. The Yankees did. And that set up the showdown at Fenway Park between a Yankees team that was fairly dynastic at the time, really. They had won the World Series the year before. They had lost to the Reds in 76. They'd be back again in 81. And this Red Sox team has parallels with another Red Sox team we're going to discuss because they're one of the best teams in the history of baseball to have won exactly Bupkis.
Yeah, and that 78 team, I remember that game like it was yesterday. Well, strangely enough, I was working in radio at the time and watching the game on a little black and white TV in the studio. I think I was running the board for the radio broadcast. And everybody remembers Bucky Dent, of course, but I remember Lou Piniella losing a ball in the sun in right field and somehow catching it, even though he couldn't see the ball.
Right. It was a day game, which is kind of strange looking now. Right now in the ALDS, the NLDS, we have like those early starts. But that's how baseball was. In fact, if I was watching the Yankees broadcast of the game, and there's this like statement early on where the broadcaster is saying, hey, look, if you don't believe that baseball is the American pastime, you need to catch this atmosphere here. And it's interesting that they were kind of like making that thesis statement even 40 years ago. Like you could almost feel like even then baseball was slipping somewhat and football was eclipsing it, but it was still holding on. And you certainly had the drama and the pageantry and the setting of Fenway Park. And it's very interesting to watch because you notice the pace of the game completely different than it is right now. And just watching the plays some of these guys made that were, I guess, kind of like pedestrian routine plays for them. Like I was watching Fisk, for instance, just in the first inning. Torres, who's pitching for the Red Sox, who's going to give up the famous Bucky Dent home run, comes out and he's clearly rattled out of his mind to start the game. You can tell looking at it now that it was not going to go well. He walks the leadoff man on four pitches. It's funny because Phil Rizzuto is doing play-by-play for the Yankees. Now, you couldn't say this anymore, but he wants to sum up Mike Torres, and he says he's an excitable Latin type. Like, oh, dear, well, that's a little problematic now. It's fun when you could used to be able to say things, though. And Mickey Rivers runs in the first pitch, and this throw from Fisk is just this dart. His release time is crazy. And then a few pitches later, he blocks this ball in the dirt that gets past almost every catcher who plays the position. And you're watching, you realize so many great players and either one of these teams kind of would have made its mark as like the best of the last 40 years. Mm. Whoever won this game, and that wasn't going to be the Sox.
And like seems to have happened in so many of those Red Sox heartbreaking games through the years, the Sox had the early lead. I think Yaz hit a home run and maybe Rice drove in a run too, but they were ahead, I think, at least 2-0.
Sure. And Rice had like a weird year because he had over 400 total bases, which I don't think anyone in the American League has had since. Yet he managed to have an OPS under 1,000, which means that he basically didn't like to walk. Yastrzemski, who's going to make the final out, and that's going to be the other lingering image from this game when he pops up like Mantle at the third. He homers off of Guidry. And you have to realize, Guidry, the lefty, Louisiana Lightning, he's going to finish 25-3 this year.
Right.
He's had one of the best seasons. Any pitcher, like Koufax, 65, 66, in that area, that any hurler has ever had. He's awesome. And Yastrzemski, again, he's a lefty hitter. This is a lefty pitcher. Yastrzemski is long in the tooth, and he jacks one. And you think, wow, this bodes well. Happy, happy auguring. And the Red Sox, like you said, they always had a tendency to get the lead. Now, people remember Game 7 of the 86 World Series. The Red Sox, after the Game 6 debacle, they had the lead in that one.
Right.
They had the lead in Game 7 against the Reds. They like to have the lead and lose the lead. And usually, Bob Stanley was somehow involved in this loss process.
Yes, as he was throwing what was not, I don't believe it was Rich Gedman's bad play. I think it was a wild pitch by Bob Stanley. And again, Buckner gets all the blame for that one. But Stanley, too, gave up, I think, a run-scoring hit after he came in relief of Torres in that 78 game.
He did, and that helped put it away. And if you look at Bob Stanley's numbers that year, and as for Buckner, I had as much to do with them losing that game as Buckner did. Once the game became tied, it was inevitable that the Mets were going to prevail in that Game 6. But moving back to 1978, Stanley goes 15-2. He is basically their late 90s Derek Lowe, who starts, who relieves, but he's better. And yet, he has, this is very difficult to do, as many bases on balls issued as strikeouts, basically.
Mm.
Like, when you think about it, how could you even manage to pull that off? So what he must have been doing all season long was inducing ground balls after he, like, loaded the bases and getting double plays. Because it was never smooth sailing with this guy. He comes in, they get behind even more, and they sort of make a valiant stand. And what's interesting, too, is one man in particular would have had a unique perspective on this game, because there was someone who was there, obviously at this playoff game, and at the playoff game that happened now 70 years ago, the Yankees manager, who's in place, this being Bob Lemon, because Steinbrenner and Billy Martin did their normal thing. Billy Martin was removed. Bob Lemon took over. Bob Lemon was a Hall of Fame pitcher. Bob Lemon had been at Fenway Park on October 4th, 1948, when something very similar played out with even higher stakes, if you can imagine that.
Well, yeah. Let's go back to 1948, the first one-game playoff in American League history. And the story of this game for 70 years has been the curious decision by the Red Sox manager.
Right, and that is clouded in much mystery. Now, the guy who ends up getting the start for these 1948 Red Sox, and you have to realize, too, that basically the Yankees were going to win the pennant in the American League every single year. And you didn't have playoffs, you didn't have divisions, you won the pennant, you went to the World Series. You just finished the first place in your league, and you are taken care of. It's just first place National, first place American, World Series winner, huzzah. And Joe McCarthy, who had been a Yankees manager, he elects to pitch a guy named Denny Gailhouse. Now, Denny Gailhouse debuted with the Red Sox in 1939, same year Ted Williams broke into the big leagues. And depending on who you believe, certain pitchers like Mel Parnell, who's basically 1940s version of Bruce Hurst, the lefty who had success at Fenway, bagged out of the game. They didn't want to be in the game. To hear Parnell say it, who was on 2 days rest, he was just chomping at the bit to get into this game. But they go with Denny Gailhouse, and this Red Sox team is back. You have Hall of Famer Bobby Dorr second. You have Ted Williams, of course, who batted a mere .369 that year. You have Vern Stevens, who was Alex Rodriguez for a while at shortstop with 29 homers, 137 RBI. And it seemed like everyone on the team had 114 runs, 124 runs, 124 runs again, 127 runs for Dom DiMaggio, who was one of the best players in the league at the time. And Ted Williams did not help the cause because he dropped a simple pop-up in left field. But the story of the day was one Gene Bearden, who had a singular career. Gene Bearden, in 1948, pitcher for the Indians, and it's his rookie year. It's his year 27th season, but he gets to finish second in Rookie of the Year. He goes 20-7 with a 2.43 ERA. You're going to love this, Red Sox fans. He lasts in the big leagues until 1953. He never once more finishes above 500. He never again finishes with more than 8 wins. He had the year of his lifetime, and then he continued in the postseason in the World Series, when the Indians played the Boston Braves. Think about that. You wouldn't have had a Subway Series. You would have had a Charlie on the MBPA Series here in Boston with the two stadiums within walking distance. But no, Gene Bearden and the great shortstop slash manager Lou Boudreau for the Indians, who invented the shift against Williams in 1946, scuppered that for us Bostonians and the generations that preceded us.
And I believe you're required by baseball's unwritten laws to refer to Denny Gailhouse as journeyman Denny Gailhouse.
Yeah, he was journeyman-ish, but he was a 500 pitcher, and it's not like the Red Sox were. They were like the 70s Red Sox. They mashed, and they got bashed when they pitched a lot of times. They had Joe Dobson, who was pretty good, 16-10. But the ERA was 3.56. You had guys, you didn't really have like an ace, like a stud. They outslugged you. I mean, it was like Edmonton Oilers type numbers. It was the RBI baseball on the old, you know, arcade system. They mashed. And Mike Torres was a bit of a journeyman too, but that was a problem for a long time with the Red Sox. And I wonder what Ted Williams would have thought that day, because he must have known Denny Gailhouse as well as anyone, having been a teammate with him for so long. I wonder if he was thinking, like, this is going to suck. This is not going to go how I wish it to go at all. But he played a part in Ted Williams, and it's not like they got drubbed 15-2. What was disappointing, I think, especially for the Red Sox and for New Englanders at the time, was they needed the Yankees. It was actually a three-team race. They needed the Yankees to lose, and the Yankees did lose. And when the Yankees lost to the Red Sox, and that just never happened. They didn't get over that hump. When they beat them and they slayed that particular pinstripe dragon, I think they thought, finally, this is going to happen. They'd had the near miss of just a few years before, a couple years before, 1946, and this was going to be their time. They were that sort of flashy young superstar team. They were kind of like, I don't know, in football, think of like the greatest show on turf, Rams. But the Rams at least got their one Super Bowl victory. These Red Sox, these 1940s, late 40s Red Sox, are some of the most compelling, talented teams of all time. And they're basically in the same category with the late 70s Red Sox, who almost did it in 77, who maybe ought to have done it in 75 and would have if Jim Rice wasn't hurt, and who didn't even get a single actual technical postseason appearance.
Right. And those Sox would come back in 1949. And if I remember right, go right down to the wire before losing out to the Yankees in the 49 pennant race.
It's the same deal. They're doing it for a handful of years at the end of that particular decade. And they're doing it the same way. And Williams was maybe not the best teammate, depending on your perspective. He would say, the reason we don't win is because we have Vern Stevens at shortstop. The Yankees have Rizzuto. Well, Vern Stevens is basically Ted Williams' offensive equivalent during this pocket of years. But he's not that guy who's making the diving stop up the middle and getting the force out at second. He's not making the key relay throw. He's maybe not driving in the run with two outs and a runner on third. Kind of a stat patter, you get the feeling that Williams felt. But again, it's so much offense. It's not enough pitching. And that Indians team, we should be fair to them in 48, they were absolutely loaded. They had half a dozen Hall of Famers. I mean, Bob Lemon was, like we said, one of their Hall of Fame pitchers. The guy who was their best pitcher was not Robert Feller, who was also on that team. And they also had, this is kind of mind-blowing, for the stretch drive, these Indians get, of all people, and people thought it was a gimmick at the time.
Satchel Paige.
Satchel Paige.
Right.
To come in. And Satchel Paige, think about how good this guy, he must have been amazing, right? To have come in, he makes his Major League Baseball debut. People don't know Satchel Paige was African-American. He played in the Negro League, and baseball, of course, was slow to integrate. The Red Sox were especially slow to integrate. That kind of bit them in their Boston arse here, in a way. Satchel Paige comes in. He's 41 years old. Pennant stretch? Yeah, I'll just drop a 6-1 on you with a sub-3 ERA. Dude was awesome. He's 41. Can you imagine like what he would have been at 31 in Major League Baseball?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He would have been like the Koufax of that era, but they wouldn't have gotten there without Satchel Paige. It's a pretty fascinating story.
Well, both are very fascinating teams. You mentioned the 78 Sox. I mean, we're all agog over 108 wins this season. 99 wins and nothing for that 78 team.
Well, you've mentioned 72 to me. And 72 was another team where Fisk has one of the best rookie seasons anyone's ever had. Louis Aparicio's on that team. And imagine how this felt. You finish a half game out of the playoffs because there was a work stoppage and you played one last game. You don't get to make it up. Think about the games yesterday. They're like not really play in games. They're not like playoff games. They're just to determine seeding. You could have gone to a tiebreaker yesterday for the Cubs and the Rockies and the Dodgers and everybody and the Brewers head-to-head, but no, they thought this is important enough, let's determine it on the field. But the 72 Sox, who might have won it all, didn't even get the chance to determine it on the field. Like, you can sort of understand why New Englanders would have thought that there was something preternatural that had a hand in how this played out over so many decades and generations.
I thought that, and that 72 team is Louis Aparicio fell down rounding third in a game that, had they won, would have sent them into the playoffs. So, yes, indeed. It's sometimes those near misses are more fun to talk about than the teams that actually made it.
Well, now, but like all people to fall down, too, right?
Oh, yeah.
People don't know this. Louis Aparicio was just one of the best base runners ever. For like the first 9 years of his career, he leads the league in stolen bases. This wasn't Dave Kingman rounding third and like falling on his head. This is one of like a Vince Coleman, like a Ricky Henderson type of speed merchant falling over his own feet, and that might have cost you a World Series that year.
Some memories, some good, some not so much, but fun nonetheless. Colin Fleming chatting with us as always on a Tuesday afternoon. Colin, thank you for joining us. Enjoy the baseball playoffs, one game or more, and we'll talk with you next week.
Sounds good.